Here we go. Welcome to episode 30 of the Never Iron Anything podcast. This podcast is an occasional chat with a buddy, mostly who seem to be coincidentally Scottish at the moment. I don't know what's going on with my life, but they do seem to be. About a comic series of creator we are fans of. We will dissect and reflect and occasionally chuckle, and that's a work in progress, that introduction. My name's Tony Esmond, writer of Tony Osmond is a Movie Star, which comes out on Thursday this week. Today we have another returning guest, the Lord of the Rookery. I took that up. Here in gorgeous black and white, it's my pal Alan Henderson. How you going, pal?
Greetings. I'm doing well.
I didn't know what rookery was. It sounds weird that it's not actually about rooks. It's about penguins. Yeah. But there you go. Yeah.
Well, the collective name for penguins is a raft, actually.
Is it? Oh, okay.
Which just sounds weird, but yeah
it does. I'm
the pilot of the raft.
You've built your reputation, my friend. It's stuck now. You never get away from it. Yeah. So what are we going to talk about today, dude?
So the book I have in front of me that I think we want to talk about is A Contract with God and Other Tenement Stories, a graphic novel by Will Eisner.
Now we're talking, man. Now we're talking. Yeah, good stuff. I have to admit, I didn't come to Eisner until late in my comic, not late, but into my 20s. I don't think I discovered him till maybe my mid-20s. He wasn't a go-to for me as a sort of Marvel DC guy. When did you first come across him?
So I would have first come across him, I'm assuming it would be about, again, it's the very early 90s.
Yeah.
I don't think he has as big a following or appreciation in the UK, perhaps, as he does in the US. And that's partially because of the original publications that he has are more newspaper based, and therefore I think there's a lot of that is, you know, wasn't transported over to the UK in a big way.
That's a really good point, man. For those that don't know, the Spirit was created as a newspaper publisher saw that comics were on the rise right at the start there, just as pulp was dying, and they decided they needed a comic to include in their newspaper, and that's what the Spirit was initially, anyway, wasn't it?
Yeah. So it was what we would now call as part of the Sunday Funnies, or where Eisner realised that given the space that he had, how did he get a 6 or 8 page story across where he could tell a whole, the whole thing in that sort of space and use all of the imagery to fill it out. So that, again, I think that didn't come across to the UK very well, or, it was
probably not at all often, I would think, you know.
Not in its original format.
Yeah.
So I found what Eisner, if you like, through A Contract with God, when Titan published the kitchen sink versions of some of his books in the early 90s. I think, for me, it was one of these things that was really odd and weird because it was a paperback that was a comic.
Yeah, that's the one I've got.
So, so the version I have for me is about, 20 centimeters wide? And, it's just slightly bigger than your standard sort of 1970s paperback. And it's really different because that version of it is on a sort of cream coloured paper and everything's printed in a sepia ink.
As I understand, that was the concept, wasn't it? It was conceived in that way. Is that right? I think I read that somewhere.
Yes. Because again, it was about it's about using the whole medium to say, how do you transport over this fact that this is a story, let me say, this is a set of stories that are set in the 1930s in Brooklyn. So you're trying to do historical positioning of it. How do you get history across? How do you make something feel like an old retelling of something that's happened? And that, so putting it on the cream paper and putting it with the sepia ink, I think, was just part of that whole piece.
Yeah. And from the beginning here, I think it's plain that we should say this is not a dry piece of work. This is not dull in any way. Even though it's on sepia paper, it's about, historical moments in, New York's history. It's not dry at all. People who haven't read it think, I can't bother to read Will Eisner, it's a bit old-fashioned. It's not at all. It may be set in the past, but it's very relevant still,
It's actually really weird to think about reading this, because if you read this now, this just feels like it fits in with every other book that you would currently see. If this came out today, it would not feel wrong.
No, exactly.
It's a beautiful presentation of a, sort of social melodrama, presenting social history about a particular subset of New York in the 1930s. But what we forget is that when this first came out, there was nothing like that. Nothing at all. This was, this would have been completely wrong in terms of people going, I don't understand.
Not in comics, I completely agree with you. But the thing that came to me when I was reading it is films like The Apartment, maybe Neil Simon, something like that. Mm. There's that. I know that's slightly later, but it's got that feel to it.
The subject matter, yes. I do mean the medium.
Right, okay, mate. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, where you're going, look, at that point, comics were either your Disney, your Donald Duck, or your something humorous perhaps, or it was straight into spandex.
Yeah.
We had romance comics and westerns and but there was nothing going, right, hang on, this is quite serious.
Yeah.
In that piece. But it's not as you say, it's not dry serious. It's a once upon a time in America type positioning. It's that
That's true. Let's set the time for people who don't know. So it came out in 78. It's a four series story. People think A Contract to God is a single story, but it's not. It's actually four stories.
Yeah.
So we've got A Contract with God, the title story, The Street Singer, The Super, the shortest of them all, actually, and I'm sure we'll talk about that, and probably the most disturbing of them all in a way for me. And then, I don't know how you say this, Cuckoline, is that how you would say it, Al?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, and they're, in the most part, set in an area called Dropsy Avenue in New York, an area of tenement buildings, and poverty, they're not rich people, are they? There's no privileged lifestyles going on there, and they are set in, what's the time, is it the 20s and the 30s, I'm going to say, is it?
I think it's more 30s. Certainly, yeah. It's post-depression, post-depression pre-war.
That's a good
World
description.
So it's that. And yeah, I think it is all set either in. It's weird because if I'm coming out from the perspective of going, I'm neither. Most of the characters in here as well are either Jewish or in that immigrant.
Yeah, mate. I was going to. This is one of my questions for you: is how do you and I, as a couple of Brit lads buying comics from newsagents, how do we relate to this? Yeah, but it's slightly alien to me.
It's the Scottish nature in me, in terms of knowing some of the Scottish history of saying, right, what was Glasgow like in terms of the tenement buildings, and Edinburgh like in tenement buildings of that period. I don't think they were any different. So, for me, I think reading it is very much about putting it in that context and saying, yes, I understand walking around the back closes of Edinburgh, saying, look, this is, the village on that sits on top of itself in terms of the one tenement building.
Yeah,
I get it from that perspective. And then just saying, it's just happens to be in New York.
Yeah.
That's how it works for me in
terms
of my head.
That's a good point, man. And having relatives from Glasgow is the most relatable city to this, because London has its tenements, and down East Lane Market and all that sort of thing, there are tenement buildings, but Glasgow that was a really enclosed community, wasn't it, for a while in certain areas? Was it the Gorbals that was knocked down? Was that a tenement society sort of?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Oh, that was part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but, really interesting. But it's also as a Jewish guy, I don't. The first one I found really intriguing, really interesting, and not alien, that's the wrong thing to say, it's slightly rude, but just a lifestyle that just wasn't known to me at all,
No, but again, I think I'm quite happy to come at it from the perspective of saying, yes, that the whole concept of faith and the whole concept of somebody being staunchly religious and turning around and saying, right, I have established a contract with my God, so that if I'm a good person, good things will happen to me.
Yeah.
Arguably, the religion of choice, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I can see it. I'm a lapsed Catholic, and I neglect my religion purposely. But I think the Catholicism was the same at the time, wasn't it? And it had the same collections and the same people who had money and didn't have money. And
I think all you're really doing there is saying that these things are common, I reckon, across all groupings and all religions and all, you can put that setting around it. Clearly this was just Will Eisner saying, look, I am Jewish, therefore I understand this is my history and my iconography, so yeah. I can put it around that. I think there is something about the way that the character ends up talking to God. It's probably distinctly Jewish.
Yeah.
And there's maybe a little bit of caricature coming in there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, let's not. He was prone to that, and I know he's been criticised for it in recent years. But yeah, he's prone to that, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, but again, this is some Will Anderson's training in terms of how to get across a comic story, where it's a case of how do you narrow down the concept to being the simplest thing,
yeah.
So that when you're then imparting it back to the reader, they immediately are on board and immediately can go, right, I know, I don't need to overthink this, I can move on to the next bit, yeah. And that's what storytelling should be.
Yeah, I think as well, to add to your voice about the Jewish iconography in it, and it does do that. I mean, even the title page in the collection I've got, God is written in that sort of script, you know, like the
yes.
It gives it I don't know, it gives it an importance, it gives it almost the pages seem to be ripped out of almost something that is biblical, you know, for all the Torah or something, you know, it's got that strength to the lettering, and some of the pages seem very I don't know how you put this, that they have a legend to them, they have a depth to them beyond just that single image.
I mean, some of that comes down to the, so if I'm looking at the first page of Contract with God, which is just after the sort of short introduction, a couple of pages, which is the fact that the title, and this is very well Eisner, the title's built into the page there.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's, you know, it looks like it's been carved in stone.
Yeah.
Which again is that you know, you can see it's Ten Commandments, but, you know, so it has that Jewish element into it.
Yeah.
And that in itself is that establishing piece of going, right, this has a weight to it, because this looks, you know, it looks like a piece of stone here with words carved into it.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does.
And he follows that up with four pages, which I'm going to say are, if you can find me four pages of comics that look wetter.
Oh, man. Oh,
right.
This is so good. I texted somebody yesterday. This is so good. It makes my guts ache. That page of the rain as he walks up those steps.
Those steps. Oh, it's there's not. It literally looks like it's a wet page of paper in front of
it
you.
It really does. Yeah.
And yet, when you actually start to look at it really closely about how tight the detail of the drawing is, it's actually quite loose.
Yep.
You know, and a lot of it's about what's not there.
Yeah.
Rather than what is there.
And there's an indication of a brick wall, but it's not completely, you know, there's an indication of a lamp, you know, a lamp with a light on it in the background. Mm. You're right, man, yeah. It's just completely accomplished, isn't it? You know, but there's a flair to it as well. You can see he's not just, he's throwing himself into this. I only did with the most of his work. I'm not sure about all the educational books he perhaps did, or, you know, what was his biggest seller? Wasn't it like How to Be a Bartender or something that was published by his company? Yeah, but this is amazing. I hadn't reread this, I'm going to say, since the first time I bought it, so the 90s. And I reread it. You suggested it to me, and I absolutely am enthralled by it. Of all the books I've done so far on this podcast, this is the one I've reread the most before we've recorded, you know? It's beautiful.
It's actually a really easy read as well.
It is. Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
And I must admit, every time I've gone back to it since, I've read it a couple of times since I bought it, but going back to it now, over the last month, I probably reread it about four, maybe five times, because you look at some of the pages and you just stop and actually get into it. And there's other pages later on that I want to talk about from that perspective.
Yeah.
Where there's, you know, there's so much happening on an individual page, but there's very little on it.
Yeah,
that it's really difficult to tell. But yeah, so in terms of the first story,
yeah,
we should probably sort
yeah. Did you want to summarize
to
it? Or yeah.
So it's Fermi Hirsch is a young boy initially from Eastern Europe, or from Russia actually, who is the only Jew saved from a village in Russia when it was being cleared out due to anti-Semitism, and he comes to New York, and
he's kind of pointed at New York by the community, isn't he? They say they have faith in him, and they give him some, you know, small amount of cash, and he travels to New York. They set up the travel, don't they?
Yeah, so he's seen as he's helped out in the village and that, so he's seen as being, you know, of good character, and therefore they send him across to New York, and he is, that as part of his leaving Russia, he establishes on a stone a contract with God, which is essentially saying, if I'm good, look after me.
Yeah.
And then at the beginning of the Contract of God story, you find out that his daughter has died, and therefore he believes that the contract with God has been broken.
Yeah, now this is something he himself didn't talk about for many years, did he? When I say
Will
that,
Eisner,
he his daughter did die when she was 17, although not adopted, his born daughter. So this is an adopted girl, and he kept that quiet for many years. Not everyone knew that because he disappeared off a bit into sort of publishing other stuff. It wasn't it wasn't that well known.
Yeah, I think it was leukemia, wasn't it?
Right,
if I remember correctly. That underpins, I think, this whole thing about, clearly he's gone through that emotional crisis of faith himself, going, I had a contract, or, God has betrayed me in terms of thing. And in terms of the story, it goes on to that he says, right, if you're going to break the contract, I'll break the contract. He becomes the a tenant, he becomes the landlord for a number of the properties in Dropsy Avenue, some of which he destroys and some of which, but number 55 he keeps.
He doesn't automatically treat everyone well, does he? He kind of switches his personality, doesn't he, a bit?
Completely goes to say, right, well,
becomes a bit of a slumlord.
I'll just be in it for the money. And during all this time as well, he's been stealing money from the synagogue, but then he makes his money back and he goes back to pay the money back to the rabbis in the synagogue, and basically at that point he says, I want a new contract with God. Now if you get to that, if you get to the pages where he's meeting the rabbis back in the elders in the synagogue, there's a page there where it's clearly meant to be that they're all sat around the table and they've got a candle on the table and that's the only light in the room. And he leans over and speaks into them.
I've got that page here,
The way he's drawn the lighting with him leaning into the table, and it's just, it's that whole one, if you hold a torch under your chin. And
you look frightening as a kid,
And it's clearly at that point he's going, look, he's basically tempting the elders back into to say, look, I've become evil, but if you never, I'll give you all the money that you need and pay you back and all this sort of stuff. But you as the learned men should be able to write a better contract with God than I ever did. And they do, just to get the money. That's essentially where the story goes, because he gets his new contract, he thinks everything's hunky-dory, and then he has a heart attack and dies.
Yeah.
Arguably the ending of the story is possibly one of the weakest bits, but this whole story arc of him going, what is a contract with God? What is it about having faith and saying, I have a relationship with God? Does that mean that everything should be good all the time?
Yeah, it's so clearly, once as a lot of religious people have, they've been told all their lives, if you do good, you'll be looked after. And that is their contract. And then he loses his daughter, and he realizes, and that this is that transposed into a piece of, a piece of theatre almost. I could see this as a play, it's a
And I think that's because some, we talked a little bit about the exaggerated artwork in some certain pieces, and the wording to me is actually, it's quite operatic.
Okay. Yeah, I get you.
That it's everything's, if everything's slightly overdone, and you're speaking to the back person in the audience, where it's been, and it has that flair around it and stuff. So if this was done as an opera, where everything's overexpanded and everything's that's where I was trying to go with it. But
I get you
again. Theatrical with that piece, but everything's slightly
like a big overplayed. Musical, and you got to remember that he hung out in the theater a lot as a kid, because his dad was they were very poor as kids, but his dad painted the scenery, didn't he, in the backdrops for the pieces.
When he first came, that was his background.
I absolutely love this man, and you're completely right, the heart attack at the end does have a little, it does hark back to the stories with a twist at the end. There's a little bit of that. I found a moment of finality that I don't think I felt cheap cheapness in any huge way, but I can see exactly what you're saying, man. It's a strange ending, but then again, it isn't.
There's the epilogue.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It isn't without an epilogue. So a kid who is being bullied, much in the same situation as our hero previously, or anti-hero, he finds the original one that he threw out the window when he rejected it after his daughter, and he picks that up, and the cycle begins again. I'm not sure when the epilogue was added. Was it? I'm guessing it was written into the original rough. We talked a little bit about this before, that Eisner would draw his comics twice. So he would draw them as a sort of roughed out copy, pencil copy, and then he would actually recreate them again. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, if in one of the kayfabe interviews online, they don't do Contract with God, but they do the Will Eisner sketchbook.
Right. Okay.
Which.
Men of great taste on that, allow me to say.
Yeah. I think the sketchbook came out from Dark Horse in about, I think, 2002 or something like that.
Okay.
But anyway, so as part of that sketchbook, it includes some of the pages, and they're also in the curated edition of the Contract with God, where he will draw a page purely in pencil, and then he'd basically, I think it was part of his writing process, where he would say, "Look, here it is, all completely roughed out, and some of these pages are not finished, and some of them are very finished."
Okay. Yeah.
But he would then present that to the editor to say, "Look, here's my roughs. Here's the full story. What do you think?"
Yeah.
Yes, no, yeah. And that's what was edited against. And then you would get that back and then just draw it all again. I presume there would be a light boxing. But it would be drawn all again to say, right, here it is. Now, if you go through the curated edition of Contract with God, there are certain pages that come in, certain pages that go out, and panel layouts and things change. But I'm going to tell you that about 95% of it is identical.
Okay, that's interesting. I've not seen that. Yeah, okay. I've got no problem with that, man. You and I have both talked about this, having watched him draw on videos. There's a great video, if you can find, Stan Lee interviewing, where he takes him away to a table and he draws on it, and he's so naturalistic. You know, there's no cheating. I don't mind it. He's light boxed that. I mean,
it's just you putting inks on top of your own pencils. Yeah, when I'm saying light boxed, I don't think there's not an awful lot of that. I think it is. There's redrawing through there. But
yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. Actually, I was reading another good book I'd recommend is Will Eisner: A Spirited Life, which is a collection of essays from Two Morrows. It's introduced by Michael Chabon and as a foreword by Neil Adams. And there's some really interesting stuff in there. And they talk about his relationship with editors, and they quote him an awful lot because he did quite a lot of interviews in his life, and he taught a lot. So there's a lot of stuff we can find out about Will. And he says, "I encourage criticism." He talked about, I think it was Dennis Kitchen, his relationship with Dennis Kitchen, who reprinted a lot of the Spirit stuff initially, didn't he, when we came back. We'll talk about history in a minute, actually. You should do that. And he said, "I encourage criticism. I want a publisher to be critical, and I want my editor to be critical." And he refers to editors are the reader's surrogate, which I find is an interesting idea from a man who we see as a singular voice, you know, but he still took the criticism. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think, again, at no point did Will Eisner fall down the trap that I think some of our esteemed members of the community have, where they became so big that they refused to, or the editor became too scared to stop them.
Yeah.
Because I think if you look at some of the books that come after Contract with God, again, it's clearly they're all very tight. None of them end up being the 800-page opus.
All stealing ourselves for that Barry Windsor Smith book that's coming any day soon.
It's a great quote from Alan Grant, which about saying the fact that Alan Moore was brilliant when he had a great editor to stop him.
I've heard that one. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. It is a lot about that. I think in that the Will Eisner very much was, saying that yes. And again, part of that is, and again, we're going to talk this. Is him being the businessman. Saying there's no point in producing something that won't sell to the broad masses.
Very much so.
And I think it's also, throughout his whole career, Will Eisner kept coming back to the fact that he really saw the medium of comics as being something greater than just being the newspaper stripper, just being the for the kids. It was something bigger than that.
He was always looking to develop stuff, wasn't he? And that's that. You can see that throughout his career. Let's talk a little bit about. Let's just give a few facts and figures. So, born in 1917, he died sadly in 2005. Notable works include, as we talked about, The Spirit, Star Jaws. I've never seen that Star Jaws. I was reading about it today. A Life Force. And what a book we were talking about last night. We were on you and I were on a drink and draw, the Awesome Comics drink and draw, and I showed to the camera that Comics and Sequential Art, which I think everyone should get. It's an incredible book. It's still in print now. You can still buy it. It was next day delivery from Prime on Amazon if you want it. You know, it's a really good book that people should all have. Is everyone goes on about Scott McCloud's book, but I rate it just as much. I think it's so good.
Yeah. Scott McCloud basically quotes the Eisner book as being the inspiration for understanding comics.
Yeah.
So, So I let's be clear as well. Eisner had four careers in comics.
Yeah, let's go through this because it's interesting.
So he started out doing the newspaper strips and the Sunday supplements.
Yeah.
Now all of that we have to. So that was primarily The Spirit. There are one or two other. Newspaper
and
strips.
People, I think the background to this is interesting and something that I know you're interested in because this fell out of the pulps. So the pulps, for those that don't know, were basically novels with the odd spot illustration and usually pretty dramatic and lovely covers, which was the cheap comics entertainment of its time. You know, books that were stolen in newsstands and stuff like that. But people began to see that the pulp market was declining slightly and that comics were on the rise. And this is, you've got to remember, this is way back. This is Action Comics One time. You know, it's that period, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know? So he was really in at the ground floor for this, and he started The Spirit in a newspaper because the newspaper decided they would up circulation by having this newfangled thing called comics in it, you know, and he started there. So you know he was always on top of the game all the way through, you know.
Yeah, and he set up his relationship with the newspaper as well, rather than selling the rights away. You know, he kept the rights, and he set up his own business. He realized that by taking a slight pay cut at that point, or you know, getting a few cents less on the page but retaining the rights, was actually going to be a better long-term positioning for that.
And this was Eisner and Iger, isn't it, was the name of the company, as I recall.
Eisner and Iger at that point in time. He had done some other work prior to that. There's a book out there called The Lost Works of Will Eisner,
right?
Which is some of the other newspaper strips that he did. Somebody found the plates and they couldn't work out who it was, and because it was all done under pseudonym.
Okay,
but it was actually just whatever Will Eisner is spelt backwards was the name of the art. And somebody went, hang on, and again, I think they ended up in the hands of Dennis Kitchen, who produced it as a book.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of really early work from that.
I mean, page rates at the time are interesting. I read a long thing about him talking about he gets $1.50 a page, but he said he was approached by some gangsters who wanted him to draw some Tijuana Bibles for him, and he said I would have got $3 a page. And I read this interview where he said, I always really regretted not taking them up on that, but I just couldn't do it. Yeah, I'd love to see a Tijuana Bible drawn by him. Oh my God, it'd be so good. Yeah.
So anyway, that was the newspaper strip time, and he established the Spirit as a thing. Spirit moved on to actually being its own.
And let's not forget, I think we might have said this before we come on, but he went to school with Bob Kane.
Yeah,
the two of them were at school, the same school that Stan Lee went to, and God knows who else did as well. You know.
Yeah, it's just crazy from that sort of thing.
Yeah. Sorry, mate. Go on, I interrupt you.
The next phase of his comic career, if you like, was 1941-ish, I think it was, where he gets called up and is taken into the army, where as part of his training or during his basic training, he's spotted being that he's drawing and doing work. I think they knew that he was the artist for The Spirit as well, so they were asking him to do things.
Yeah.
And basically the army adopted him as the resident artist for producing books and manuals to get information across to the GIs to say that this is how things work, or this is how various pieces work. Now, this is a relationship that lasted right through until the late 60s.
Yeah.
And there's a set of not so much stories as manuals about how to use whatever particular rifle it was that was designed for the Vietnam War. They're all drawn by Will Eisner. And it's a case of, this is how you maintain it. This is how you keep it clean. This is what you do with it.
This is his character. Was it Joe Dope was the character he drew? Yeah.
And, you know, so it's basically a mix of saying a practical manual combined with some humor comics, if you like, going up saying, if you get this wrong, it blows up in your face. Or if you don't tighten the wheel nuts correctly on the Jeep, the wheel will fall off and roll down the road. You know, so you can see, but the actual mix there of saying, look, this is an educational tool, but also presented in a humorous light, meant that it was getting, it was the means by which to get across the information to a number of GIs who perhaps, well, certainly wouldn't pick up a big, you know, telephone book manual of going, this is how everything hangs together, but putting it into that nice format of going, it's a comic, you know, understand how to read a comic, you know, it feels warm and fun. And, you know, so it was getting, there was a, you know, and I think that fed his realization that comics were so much more than just being the, you know, an entertainment tool and could be used for anything in terms of that broader piece.
You're right, he stuck with that. So he dropped out of the comics that you and I would know to do books like that all the way through to the 70s, didn't he? Pretty much, late 60s, And but worth remembering is, while he was away at war, the spirit continued. And you had people like Jack Cole, Lou Fine, Jack Keller, who were ghosting him. And people forget that the spirit didn't actually run very long. It only ran, was it 8 years or something like that, I think? Something along those lines. But a lot of it wasn't by him, interestingly. But he had set that stylistic thing up where people knew what to do.
Yeah, or it certainly wasn't by him by the time it moved out of the pure newspaper pieces.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, totally.
I must admit, everybody thinks that I should be a spirit fan because obviously I'm such a big fan of The Shadow. Yeah. But I'm not.
But
it's
different, man, as well.
Oh, yeah. Hugely. And I think that's, you know, when you have, I also struggle to get into some of it in terms of, it's very of its time, shall we say.
Yeah, there's a few caricatures that you will cringe looking at.
So as part of that practical maintenance piece, he also, you know, he realized that you could also do advertising through comics.
Yeah.
And therefore that moved, you know, that was the next stage of his career. I feel like he moved into this advertising process of using comics again to, as you say, things like How to Be a Bartender.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and he set up his own publishing company at that point.
Yeah.
Again, being a businessman and actually taking control of it and saying, I'm going to take this through. And that led him also into a stage of going, well, actually I can become an educator. And he took up a role at one of the New York art colleges.
Yeah, I haven't got it in front of me, but yeah, he maintained for decades, I think, you know.
Yeah, and I think this is where there's an interesting, one of the reasons I think he is so highly respected by the American artist community is that so many of them went through his hands.
Yeah.
And as you know, or certainly saw a lot of these teaching materials, and therefore they knew him a lot from that, and were able to look back to the spirit and back to other pieces and say, well, yes, I entirely understand how this is the importance of this.
Yeah, if you search far enough on YouTube, there's loads of videos of him teaching in front of a class. And it's not as you would imagine at some grand New York university in a big lecture hall. It's in a classroom, you know, like a school classroom. Yeah. But this guy does it, and you watch him. It's mesmerizing because you've got these kids all sitting in front of him, mostly with sort of 60s and 70s haircuts, and he's drawing on the blackboard on a bit of paper tied up, you know, glued onto the blackboard. Yeah. Or something. It's beautiful stuff. Yeah, really lovely. Yeah.
And then I guess the final stage of his career was returning back to graphic novels, where. Yeah. You know, Contract of God arguably was, it's not the first graphic novel.
No.
You need to be very clear about that, despite the fact that a number of people call it that.
The only reference I could find to the first one was Jack Katz's First Kingdom, on the grounds that it had graphic novel written on the cover in 1974. But it depends what you read and what interviews you read as to whether it claims that he invented it or not.
I don't think he ever... He himself, he's an interview saying he did not invent the term.
I saw an interview where he said... He was going up to see a publisher, and he had a Contract to God ready to go to show in a rough form. And the guy said to him, what is it? And he didn't want to say comics. So he said, it's a graphic novel. He doesn't claim at that point to invent the word. He just says that's the word he used because he knew it's a little bit hoity-toity. You know, as we do now, as we say, it's the Hampstead, you know, the Hampstead crowd in London, as we like to call them. They think that's going to get it in the door of a publisher, which is still the case. Yeah. It still happens now, you know.
It well, I think it's... yeah, the term now has lost all meaning.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
weird thing is, actually, if somebody said, if this was new and out on the shelves today, we would probably go, it's not a graphic novel because it's four short stories.
Yeah, it's a collection, you know? Isn't it? I suppose we call it, yeah.
It's, yeah. And certainly some of his later books, think Life Force, which was the next book, I think, yeah. in the Dropsy Avenue series, originally was published in the Will Eisner Quarterly,
right.
across yeah. five or six issues.
You can still pick that up quite cheaply as well. I've got a few issues here myself. Yeah, it's not an expensive thing to buy.
If you've got an issue 7, let me know.
Okay, good. I'll have a look. You're such a shyster. I'm gonna out you now. You have a number of versions of this book, don't you? You've got the original one, haven't you? Is that right?
So I've got three versions of A Contract with God.
Yeah.
Got the artist that or curator edition.
Yeah.
My edition that I got from 1990, and then I've got one of the 1978 soft covers. Yeah.
Good work, man. Good work. Yeah. Just for those that are listening along, I've got the Norton collection. I've got the original, I've got the Titan version like you, and I bought the hardback, the Contract with God trilogy, so it's got all three of them in. It's got a Life Force and Dropsy Avenue in it as well. And it's not expensive. I think, I can't remember what I paid for it. It's $24.99 or something.
None of these are.
Yeah, it's a great little book for your bookshelf, that one. Yeah, really good.
Yeah, so, shall we return to the
Yes,
book?
Good idea, yeah. Yeah, so we've talked about A Contract with God. Should we do The Street Singer? The Street Singer becomes more lascivious in a way. The themes that we saw in the original one are still there, so poverty and frustration, hopelessness, you know, a certain amount of human weakness, but he shows someone who is pretty much without any kind of ethical basis, who's the street singer now. What that was is between the tenements back in the day, singers would go and sing between the buildings to entertain the people on their balconies and stuff. And the people on the balconies would drop small amounts of money down, and he would collect the money. And they were known personalities with great, you know, operatic voices who would go and perform songs between buildings. And this is what this guy is. But he's not a good guy either. He treats his family badly. His wife has got a young baby and also is pregnant. He gets taken in, albeit very briefly, by a sort of failed pastor-time opera singer who's quite fond of herself. He sleeps with her and uses her for money, which he then goes and buys whiskey with. And it's a sad morality tale in a way, isn't it? It's about pride and about being used by the people, you know?
I think it's about the multi-faced as well.
Yeah.
In that he, or when you first meet him in this, you've no concept of his backstory of the fact he has a wife and child.
That's
true. You're just going, oh, here's a guy who's a singer.
Yeah.
And then he meets the opera singer, you know, who takes him in.
And it's when...
It's a different face. But and then the face at the home, and then the face of him in the bar.
Yeah.
Each one of the two going, you know, who is the real character here?
Yeah.
Now, again, there are some pages in this that, you know, if you're purely coming at it from not wanting to enjoy the story, but just enjoy the art and know how to put a comic together.
Yeah.
The other thing I really want to call out, this is probably one of the first books that I read where there's the importance of the panel border is no longer important.
This story has less one-page splashes. The first story uses a lot of single images on a page. This doesn't, yeah.
But also, how often does the panel not have a border?
Yeah. And it bumps into panels that do, which is a really interesting way of doing it. Yeah.
So if you turn to it, there's a page. One of the problems is
we've got different versions.
It's only about the 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth page in, when the pages aren't numbered, isn't it?
Right.
But it's him on his knee looking up to her.
Right.
To begin with.
Yeah.
So there's three panels on this page. One where it's just him on his knees picking up coins, basically, or picking up a note that she's thrown down. It's a panel where she's looking down from a window to him, and then the third panel is basically her in the room being excited about the fact that he's picked her note up. Now, if you follow his eye line in panel one, it's called a 45 degree angle, right, just to make it easy. Then in panel two, the 45 degree angle is taken by the washing line.
Okay.
And then panel four, the 45 degree angle is still there, but it's taken by the window ledge, or again,
down
it's still
through the panel and out to the street, isn't it? Almost, you know,
And it's just about how to compose a page about keeping the eye line moving but you're also going swoosh through each panel, swoosh. I should say as well, it's entirely silent, this page, but you know exactly what's happened in between.
Yeah, and there's real movement to it, isn't it? And it keeps rolling. It,
There's a whole thing here about, there's that page, and then I'm going to take you, if you go quite a bit further into this particular storyline, where he's at the, he's just been thrown out of the bar.
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
So this is post the sexy bit,
Post the sexy bit. But again, it's a one, two, three, it's a four-panel page here. Okay, it has one word in the whole thing where he's getting thrown out of a bar and basically he picks himself up,
love that.
Sorts
love
his hat out, and then throws it. Again, there's nothing being said here, but it's all about the movement and all about the... And again, no panel border for the middle piece, and the panel border on the third panel there is broken, actually, so with his hat. Now, this was something I think Will Eisner was really keen to express, the fact that within comic telling and comic stories, it's the space between the panels is as important, because you fill in the movement there, and it's about constructing a character and putting movement in, but into a static image. How do you, you know, and how to do that? And comics is that graphic storytelling of saying it's from A to B and B to C.
Yeah, which is what I've got a feeling he coined. I've heard him... Someone say to him, this is why you call it sequential art, in an interview. And I don't know whether he coined it. I'm not 100% sure on that. But that's exactly what it is, you know.
Yeah. I mean, and it's exactly what he in the interview that he does online that is with Stan Lee, it's very much about that. About saying, look, here's some very simple images, but you know exactly the passage of time in between each. Yeah. And how, you know, what happens in all of them. And I think this page of him being thrown out the bar and standing up and throwing a gesture back to the barman is a perfect example of that, of saying there's, you know exactly what's happened there.
And let's not forget that's the penultimate page. So the slowing down and the quietness extends through into the next page to him just going back to work, you know, and singing. Yeah. And then we get the final word, street singers played at tenement. Played a tenement only once. There were, after all, plenty of alleys, which is so great a bit of writing. So after that silence, and then you get that, and then the book that particular story ends so well done. Yeah, beautiful. Now,
but
sorry, man.
Very tragic in the middle.
Yes.
Yeah. Then
the super. Now, it's stylistically, this changed slightly. So if you look at the, I don't know if you've got the same version as me, but the opening page of the super is very well rendered. It's very indeed, you've got all the pipes and the bricks and him in the basement by the boiler, which is where he spends a lot of the time in this story with his dog. This is the one that upset me the most. I can't watch stories that dogs die in.
I must admit, having said to you, oh, let's read this. And then I read it before you'd got around to it again. And I went, oh, my God, the dog dies.
And that's not the worst bit of the story either.
No, it's not.
This is another example we talked about earlier. This is not a dry book. This is a book that, oh my God, really? This would be an episode of Law and Order. You know, it's like so. The super is this big, huge, fat, skinhead-looking guy. I posted the picture of him just sort of spitting when he says tenants, and he's this ogre, and he doesn't, you know, he does spend all day in the basement, and it was quite an underpaid job, and the landlords would employ these people to look after the building, like you say, and would always have to deal with moans about the heat and stuff like that, and he's a racist. He says Jews all the time, they complain, which even, I don't know about you, man, as a slight aside, when I read the dialogue in this, it adds an accent in my head because of the way it's written. Yeah.
Well, this is one of the ones where if you actually have the curated edition where it has the pencils, there is an additional page that sits between the, how do I put it? Where he's looking at the pictures of the naked ladies before the young girl joins him. There's a page there where he's basically remembering him as a young boy and becoming a young man and so on and so forth. And as part of that, you see him in a German uniform in from World War One.
Oh, really?
Essentially.
Okay.
But that page never made the final.
Oh, right.
Book. So obviously, that's one clue the editor's got. And to be fair, it doesn't actually add to the story anywhere. It's more just,
an interesting point.
It's an interesting side point. So you're saying you put an accent in there. Yeah, it is that. Yeah. He's clearly the landlord's man. But yeah.
You're costing me money again, Henderson. I'm going to have to buy this. So the basic of the story is he's this guy who works in the basement, but you go back to his room. He goes to a family complaining about the heat and about her daughter having to take an ice cold shower, and it turns out the daughter is very young. And I can't remember what age they said now. Was it 12?
At the end of the story, they say she's 10.
Right, okay. And
she doesn't look 10 in that first
She doesn't.
Picture,
she, I, yeah, more 12, 14, something like that. But yeah, 10. Yeah. And she is precocious, and she is... you do find out that, because that's the twist. But the he's in his basement room. It's covered in pictures of naked women. You know, that he's, which weren't easy to come from in the 30s. I've got to tell you, you know, not being alive in the 30s, but I can't imagine you couldn't print them off X Hamster back then. And he he's seen this girl, and he sort of hesitated as he walks out. He's got a sort of a dropped look in his face with his pipe, and he's playing on his mind as he walks down the steps into his room. And Eisner creates a masturbatory scene of him getting sweaty and looking at these images, and then the girl appears. And the girl realizes what he is, and lifts a skirt to him, and then cons him by killing the dog and stealing the money box. Yeah. But the thing is, she's the Punisher, apart from a bit of thievery. You know, it's like she's done him, isn't she? This ruins him.
Yeah. She's certainly, you know, he's portrayed as the baddie throughout this story, but she actually is, because she's done the whole thing. What was it, that the page where she says you wanna, and she's threatening to lift her skirt. The panel under on that page where it's his four faces of him just taking the drink and wiping his, the. As one panel with four faces all overlapping each other, you can't find many panels that express that much emotion and thought process of the character, where clearly he's going from the no, this is I can't, to well, maybe I should, and well, why not?
And he's drinking as well all the while.
Yeah. And again, the fact it's just one panel is just what amazes me to tell that much story through one panel. It's
incredibly well done. And it's the shortest, I think, I'm going to say, of the stories. Is that right? It seems to be, anyway.
I think so.
And if you, funny enough, you just having you mentioning the German uniform, it looks very like a Luger, the gun he kills himself with. If you go to that page.
Yes. Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
oh. Interesting. I'm not sure whether Lugers were invented or used by the German army at that time, but yeah. It ends with the girl. It's got that twist again. We've got a twist, which we're used to by this point, because we got it in the first story. But she's counting the money from the safe whilst whistling, and behind her is a sign that says "Super Wanted," and the last page is a close up on that. Yeah, it's an interesting one, man.
Your last page close up was not in the original book. That was something that was added for the later
editions. Okay, for the stupid people who didn't get it. Yeah, I get you. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, you can see that. That's really interesting. The first three stories in this I find much tighter than the final story. I think the final one has a soap opera-y kind of element to it. It does have its own morality in it as well. But
it's also the wordiest.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it really is. And it rambles a little bit to me. If you weren't paying attention, you might have trouble figuring out who's who amongst it to start with, I think.
There's kind of... You know what? It's either not long enough or it's too short. You know, it's because there's arguably three
stories in it.
In it about the... So, let's see. The fourth story, Kukulin, is Dirty Dancing, but set in the 1930s rather than the 1950s. Yeah, yeah. Right? So it's about the fact that coming to the summer holidays, and a number of people are going to a... Well, it's called a holiday camp
a very cheap holiday camp.
Shorthand. And there's the fact that there's different ways to go and stay there. There's one family who basically the mother goes up to live in the kitchen and basically does a working in the kitchen as a sort of means for paying for the kids to be on holiday.
And I think that's what cookaline means, is that right? It's kind of you cook whilst on holiday, I'm guessing.
But there's also two other. There's a storyline of a young girl who lives in Dropsy Avenue who basically wants to meet the man of her dreams and, you know, ideally meet somebody who has money. Yeah. So she goes out of her way to buy an expensive dress to, you know, look like she's somebody who should be picked up by an expensive, by a well-to-do gentleman who's on holiday there. There's a young lad, again, who goes the other way and has, he hires an expensive car. So he looks like he is the one with all the money when he gets there. Yeah. And you can, you know, so you know exactly what's going to happen going into it, going, yeah, the two of them are going to think that each other's the well-to-do and they're going to get together. Yeah. But the twist, arguably, is the fact that he then decides to essentially sexually assault her. And, you know, that's, you know, and she ends up getting rescued by what looks like one of the cheaper stuff. Well, somebody who plays in the band.
Yeah.
Until it's revealed that he's a medical student who's about to become a doctor. So actually she does end up meeting the man of her dreams.
Yeah.
But there's weird other stories that flick through this about the fact that the mother of the family who goes up to support the kids by going to the holiday camp first, the husband there stays behind and has an affair.
Yeah, and she knows about it. It's that the real social drama here. You know, genuine social drama. She knows about it, but for the sake of the family and sake of their lives and the fact they can't afford to do anything else, she allows it to go on.
Yeah. And the eldest son of that family that grows up, he gets entrapped by a cougar, if you will,
who wants to have time. Cuckolded and situation. Yeah.
And then the husband and that finds it, but he's actually okay with it as long as he gets to slap her around, and she's quite happy about that.
Yeah.
There is one of the best characters in terms of, again, being sort of caricature, is there's the two young kids as well, who, and the way that he draws her with the buck teeth and the glasses, that's very, it's almost Mad Magazine. It's Kurtzman.
Yeah, moments of that I see Kurtzman in a lot of this. Yeah, definitely. With a more of a sort of bombastic sense of humour, this could easily have been in Cracked or Mad, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's all these multiple storylines sort of overlapping with each other, which could have been a huge book in its own right, if you like.
It moves into a much denser, much more soap opera-esque storyline than the three earlier ones are much cleaner and tighter and, you know, thematically driven. These, I don't know if I enjoyed the last one as much as the first three, man. I'll be honest with you. I found it satisfying, but I didn't enjoy it as much. Yeah, and you're right, the wordiness.
It's not as clear as to... It doesn't take you in, tell the story and take you out again.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And part of that as well, I think, and again, this is where I think you've got an extra page that I don't have, because it was another piece that was out. So the final page is the guy standing on the balcony, basically looking out over...
Yeah, so that's my final part. I've got that one.
You've probably got an extra
it's kind of a filler illustration thing of a word.
Yeah, which was added for later editions. So it doesn't really end, or it ends on a nothing changes piece. Well, a lot of the other stories end on a and something has changed, whether it's the kid picking up the contract or the girl running off with the money, or, you know, it's, well, this one doesn't have, you know, this is almost a, as you say, soap opera piece of going, and next week it will all happen yet again.
We do, by the end of it, you do see, okay, it's another morality tale. You know, the good people do well in a way, the bad people don't. But it's, again, I found it quite upsetting. There's quite a raw sex rape scene, isn't there? It's just horrible.
You and I never discuss happy books.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. There's always very rapey, our books. Something I don't know what's going on with it. With her saying no, stop. I mean, and the elements of the super story as well. There's he plays with violence and he plays with sex in these books in a way that, because it has a retro look to it, it has, although it was made in the 70s, it has, like you say, it has that Kirkman, it has that sort of Mad Magazine 50s illustration in a way. It's slightly dated in the illustration. I find it more shocking because of that, because I didn't expect it. I think when you go into these books, certainly as a kid, I went to this book and said, oh, this looks like some old bloke's drawn it, you know, and you think, it's this. There's real lively and scary and brutal moments to it. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's not drawn. Yeah. It's certainly not drawn in any sort of titillation, because if you look at the older woman when she knows that, you know, the husband's having an affair, and basically she, you know, she lifts up her saggy breast to say, well, what about me, yeah, type thing. You're going, yeah, look, that's just a reality thing of, you know, how to present somebody, but, you know, but you're going, oh, but there's nudity in this book. Yeah. And you say, well, yeah, but it's
and, I don't think, I think I've got it here in front of me here. Am I right in thinking that a neighbour can hear them? Oh no, there's something else. Pardon me. But the well, the neighbour who's the cougar can hear this through the wall.
And, yeah,
yeah. Incredible stuff, man. Very strong. Yeah.
So one of the lines I read from Paul Levitz that I thought was kind of sums up the book.
Yeah.
And possibly some of the other the Life Force and Dropsy Avenue, was basically that Will Eisner was the cartoonist laureate for the Jewish immigrant.
Okay, yeah.
And I thought that was a really nice way of sort of summarising it. And this book basically, you know, as I say, it's a social history book.
Yes, it is, yeah. It's, in fact, Eisner himself described comics as a folk literature, which I found is quite an interesting phrase. And this is what this is. It's the story of a community of people. You know, folk literature is perfect, yeah.
So there's a fascinating story as well about when it first came out, about what Eisner going into a bookshop, because that was his big thing as well. He deliberately didn't get the book originally published through Kitchen Sink Press because he wanted it to be a New York publisher, and that's when he went with Baronet. And it was he went into a bookshop, and it was on the table at the front of the shop, and it was doing reasonably well, I guess. He then went back a week or so later to see how things were going, and obviously, you know, it was no longer the new book, so it wasn't the front. And so he was speaking to the manager of the bookshop, and says, how's it doing? And it was, he didn't know where to put it.
Okay, there's a problem we still have. Yeah, which is evidence of him being very forward thinking for all of his career. Yeah.
You know, and it was a case of, because, well, now we've got graphic novel sections in Watterson's, or whatever. I mean, what goes in those sections is open to debate, because you've got everything from Batman through to building stories, or even Joe Sacco stuff. While, you know, but at this point, 1978, when this was the first book of its ilk to go straight into bookshops, it was a, you know, it's got the word God in it. So do you put it beside the religious texts? But it's not a religious text. Do you put it, you know, nobody, you know, you can't put it with the kids' books because it's not a kids' book. How do you, and I think, you know, it then suffered for a period. And I think that's one of the reasons that it was then picked up later by Kitchen Sink when they were able to republish it in the mid-80s. By that point, things had moved on enough to turn around and say, yes, we can put out an actual book that is a comic and actually feel comfortable about getting it out onto the shelves a lot more, you know, a lot easier. Which is why I think nowadays, if this was a new book today, arguably it'd get lost amongst everything else that's coming out. But it would still, you know, it'd have its place much better.
Yeah, I think you're right, man. It'd be interesting. I'd love to find out, because you get these religious bookshops that pop about, you know, you see them. Some of them have been there for years, haven't they, you know. I wonder whether it ever made it into them. It'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Yeah, I'd like to know that. Talking about Baronet quickly. So Baronet was, who published Eisner's first version of this, Contract with God, was it something of a new venture at the time, and wasn't financially that well, didn't do that well. And he ended up giving them a loan of 25 grand just to keep them going at one point. So he had real faith in it as a form. The full quote I quoted earlier from him was, comics are folk literature and they are now a literary form. So he was very much at the forefront of pushing it as that. And he expressed some opinions where film is an extension of comics. So he says, if film jumped out of comics from that movement. And that was the immediacy of his between the panels, how he put that constantly, you know, as part of his teaching, and as he does with the sequential art book. You know, it's really interesting. Well, the other thing I meant to mention is one of the first reviews for this was by Denny O'Neill, who we lost the other day. Denny O'Neill reviewed it in the Comics Journal and praised it very highly. It was very much down to Denny's review in the Comics Journal, which everyone read at the time, as cementing its reputation from that moment onwards. Yeah. It's always talked about. It's still a book that's talked about now. It's still a book that's talked about. I mean, we know whenever there's a newspaper article, wham, bow, punch, you know, oh, no, we've got graphic novels now. They mention this, don't they? You know, so that sort of thing that jumps out.
Well,
so,
yeah, well, that's when it often gets claimed to be the first graphic novel. You know, so that's, you know, since then, it's this,
We can pick holes in that all day, can't we, if we wanted to? But, yeah, it's certainly cemented it, I think, is the way that I often see it.
The relationship to film's an interesting one, because the other thing I wonder about this at times is, you know, is Will Eisner the Orson Welles?
Ah, I like
comics?
That parallel, yeah.
And is this Citizen Kane? Because, you know, the argument could be, you know, did Orson Welles achieve anything better after Citizen Kane?
Yeah.
And everybody claims to have seen Citizen Kane, but most people haven't. And I think it's the same with Contract with God. A lot of people may be right, man. Oh, yes, I know all about it, and it's not. So, you know, it is... You know, it's upheld as being something, because, you know, is it a perfect book? No.
Yeah.
But, it is the book that, and it's Eisner's choice of epitaph. You know, this is the book that carved the path in the woods.
Yeah.
In that this is the, you know, it said, look, follow me because we can do this. And everything that comes after it is, you know, owes it a debt. So there's a lot of that, I think, that comes into it.
I'm as you are, and we both talk about this all the time. We are comics obsessives, Al. But we both have clearly put quite a lot of study into this, into going forward to talk about this today, and I really appreciate it, man. It's really good. But I do find myself completely enamoured with this book. I just am absolutely back in love with it. It's so beautiful. There's moments of it which, like you say, there's a lot of people who claim to read it, and there's probably not a lot of people who have. I wish people did read it, because it would improve all this autobiographical comics that we see these days. That the sense of pacing and the inks and everything in it is just so gorgeous. Yeah, it's just... Yeah.
Again, I think it's the thing Eisner called himself was that this is a combination of invention and recall.
Yeah, nice. Yeah.
And a lot of the biographical stuff that's out now is just too much recall and not enough invention.
Good point, yeah.
And about putting the spin on it to say, look, this is, you know... And again, part of that is like saying, look, it's caricature, or it's the... I go back to that point about being theatrical or being operatic, where you're like going, look, you need to, there are certain things you need to overemphasize, and there's certain things you need to play for the quiet moments.
Yeah.
And he, you know, this book has it, all of that in it, whether it's the super piece where there's so much quietness, but there's so much, you know, if you want to put a soundtrack to the super, that would be, you know, I can only imagine, what, you know, but it would be very Wagner-esque.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and Cuculean, even though we've said it's the weakest story in here, if that was the only story, you know, if you read that as part of an anthology, if anything else, you would turn around and go, it was brilliant. Yeah. So we shouldn't
if I had to say a song, I'd say that's a jazz song. Yeah, there's moments of, you know, high music. But the comparison between comics and music is something I've sort of thought about quite a lot before. And in this, you don't get a big soaring chorus before you get a quieter moment sometimes in great songs, and that's what he does so well here. There's oh, I can't remember the term, but there's a word for a quiet moment in music before you burst into something louder, and he does that so well. And the way that the triumphant ending of the third story about the singer is just so beautifully done. I just love it so much. It was funny enough, I was just reading some quotes by him yesterday, and there's one that he applied to The Spirit, but it applies to everything he does, because he did do that groundbreaking. He did break ground a lot in pushing ideas. And he said the need begets the invention. So there was a need for comics. There was a need for The Spirit in newspapers, so it was created. There was a need for graphic novels for this longer form storytelling, so he created it. You know, he invented it. Really brilliant, really interesting stuff. The other thing he said was, our society needs mythological creatures, which was an interesting quote from him. And when you think that these are larger than life, they're broad-based characters who tell moments in time. Interesting. Yeah.
Mm.
Mate, superb. Did you have any other moments you wanted to mention from it, or?
No, I suppose the only other thing I was going to say was, you know, it's about placing Eisner in context with some of his peers.
Yeah,
and that I wrote down three people that I think are probably equally important, but So I wrote down Kurtzman, Kirby, and Spiegelman.
Okay, it's three. Interesting. Yeah,
And it's because, again, they're all from that sort of era and piece. But it's Kurtzman, as you say, created a style with Mad Magazine. Yeah. If you see Mad Magazine now, it looks like Kurtzman.
Yeah, it does.
You know, or you can trace it all the way through. And I think anybody who sees, they might not know his name, but anybody who sees a Mad Magazine image knows what it is.
Yeah.
You know, Kirby was Marvel, New York, you know, in terms of
still
that.
Is.
And still is. And obviously Spiegelman is the one that perhaps has the name recognition because, you know, with Mouse winning the Pulitzer. Yeah. And all of them with Eisner, you know, stand together, but they're carrying different things. And I don't, despite the fact the Eisner Awards are called the Eisner Awards, I don't think, certainly in the UK, he has the same respect as the other three.
Because I worry about this because everyone goes, oh, it's won an Eisner. You ask people who'd say that in the London or wherever it is comic scene, and say, have you read much Eisner? Watch their faces. Mm. Yeah. It's like Russ Manning. Oh, have you read any, you know who that is? Yeah, so people don't know, do they?
Yeah. So wasn't he the guy that copied all the work by that other artist?
Yeah. It's a shame, isn't it? Yeah, one day we'll have the Hendos. That's what I'm waiting for. It's on my list.
I do think, and I think it's partially because Eisner stayed very grounded and made sure that he kept the business side of things as important. Kurtzman and Kirby didn't make the money that, you know, they perhaps should have done under for what they, you know, the groundwork that they laid, but their art styles are held up as being the ones that everybody remembers. Yeah. And again, Spiegelman, again, did one thing and left. It would be the that's really underplaying.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So I do think that it's weird that Eisner, and again, I don't know if it. Maybe it's a UK thing, and I keep saying that because I don't think in the UK we get the spirit of the same.
I think you're right, man.
The States get it.
It's the newspaper. The newspaper thing. We didn't have it as much. Well, we had it in a different way than them. And there's, like you say, the Sunday funnies and those bits that you'd pull out and give to the kids were a huge part of American culture for decades. You know.
Yeah, but it's in the same way that nobody in the States would know who Leo Baxter
was.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Right. Despite the fact, sadly, there's a lot of people in the UK who won't know who Bill Baxendale is. But, you know, despite the fact that his art is so important to UK comics that, it should be held up. To be honest, the UK Comics Awards should be called the Baxendales. There you go.
Another strange twist there is that he's also a man that championed the creator rights. Creator own rights, you know, which is the same way that Eisner was at the forefront early on, much before anyone, Vertigo invented it. No, they didn't. You know, it's like it had been going for years before that. Yeah, no, totally, man. Yeah. Dude, that's absolutely brilliant.
Cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed that. The only last question I've got for you, one statement, which is you and I both have a fascination with American cities, and New York is a fascination of mine and has been for decades, I think. That's kind of one of the reasons I enjoy it, and one of the reasons I wonder about New York is guys like Eisner, you know, when I'm there. And the other thing is, who do you think's taken his place? Who do you think? Have we got anyone who is now creating those singular voices about a singular thing? What do you think?
So I actually think Joe Sacco is one of the people that should be held up in that vein now. He's got a completely different route, as in a lot of his work
political,
is very journalistic.
Yeah, that's a better word.
And I think there's a lot, you know, that I've not read enough of his stuff because some of it's quite dense, denser than but I think there's something in there probably would be the sort of place I would go next if people are looking for what is the modern day.
Yeah, I mean,
and again, I think that's partially because I think if you in 10 to 15 maybe 20 years time actually when to go back and read some of Joe Sacco's book again, they will represent that historical relevance of saying this is positioning some of these stories, and that's probably where I would put it in terms of that
context. I see what you mean. I'm hard pressed to think, man. I can't think of anyone. I was going to say Klaus, but I think it's because Klaus is on my mind, and I think he's very different. I think there's a different aesthetic there. I don't know. I was going to say maybe Fingerman for his New York, New Jersey stuff, but again, a different aesthetic. Yeah, Alex Robinson, even who doesn't have the skills that he's got. It's a weird one, isn't it? It's strange. And I think we are losing those singular voices, those guys who... Because the thing about Eisner is you listen to him talk, and he's incredibly interesting and has an absolute genuinely glint in the eye. So fond of watching, you know, I love him so much watching him talk, you know. But you know, he was a fierce, he'd like Stan in a way. They were both fierce bastards in business, I'm sure, you know. And we don't have that enough. We have these people who are sort of slightly, oh, look at me, I'm an artist, I sit in my house and draw comics. You know, we don't have that enough out there, you know, people wearing a shirt and tie and also creating some of the most beautiful art in the world.
Well, yeah, and that's arguably the last of the generation that would sit at the drawing board with a tie on.
Oh, I think of you like that, Al. It's fun.
Oh, sadly not. I mean, the other single voices, I think you're right, because you start going down some of the very artistic sides. You've got people like Chris Ware, who, but I don't, that, sometimes I do wonder if there's, no, because the content is there. Chris was a lot harder to read.
I find him very...
I don't think it's accessible.
That last one of his, I forget the name. Is it Rusty Brown? I still haven't finished it. It's still sitting here. I'll keep staring at it. You know. Yeah, I know what you mean.
You know, it's like Building Stories was an amazing box of things, but I don't know if I got everything from it that I should have, and I don't feel it's as accessible to pick back up and get back into.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, anyway, sorry, I don't mean to criticize. This should be about building up.
And guys, we'll have to do a cube at one at some point. You know, there's these guys. It's so natural. It's so brilliant. It's so amazing. Yeah, it's like, yeah, good-o.
Yeah, problem you've got with cube art is what do you
know?
Pick?
Do you pick this? Yeah, because a lot of his, I've got the Sarajevo book here, and I don't feel it quite as much as some of his other stuff.
Or do you go the Tarzan stuff? Or do you go
something? Yeah. Well,
Tor.
Yeah, I actually really like Tor, I have to say.
Enemy Ace, there you go. Enemy Ace. That would be my...
Yeah, his wartime stuff's amazing, isn't it? It's brilliant. Yeah. Good. Okay, dude. Right, we're going to pause for an advert here, and I'm going to probe you about yourself in a second. Today at lunch, I had a knobbly bobbly, one of my favourites, but it didn't really touch the sides. Sometimes you just need more than a saucy-sounding ice lollipop to satisfy you. Sometimes you need heroin. Chase the dragon, or inject straight into the vein. It's heroin that really hits the spot. Our operators are ready to take your calls. Legal warning may contain brick dust or rat poison, may cause death and or lack of sexual appetite. Okay, we'll be back to our main sponsor next week, Twitter, but at the moment it's heroin. Okay, dude.
I'm told it's really more.
Yes. Yeah, it smells of kippers. Don't tell anyone I told you that. So what's going on in the world of Penguin, dude? I'm wearing my Penguin t-shirt. That is 100% genuine at this moment in time. Yeah.
Cool. Penguin, we are on page 70 of the next 100-page collection, I think, or thereabouts at the moment.
You're a machine, yeah.
So it'll be coming soon in terms of, well, I'll get to 100 pages, then I'll kickstart it because I'll wait till it's finished. It continues along on
any
that
more
basis.
Side projects? Because I know you do occasionally do the odd side thing, don't you? Is anything you got planned?
Nothing really, though. It was interesting to be at the Drink and Draw last night and forced myself to do something that wasn't, though I did draw a Penguin as well, but you know, forced myself to draw something else. I had the watercolours out then. And I actually did do a Penguin, but it was the Batman character rather than just to make
sure. We'll go after them in copyright terms soon. Yeah, next time. Yeah.
Something like that. So, no, that, but you know, because obviously the convention seems dead this year and everything. I said getting the next Penguin book out to be on Kickstarter and get that out to people is going to be the big thing, I think, for this year.
Kickstarter's taken over, man. Kickstarter's one day, I kind of have this theory, will replace Diamond. You know, it seems to be the way, the pre-order. And we're finding those reliable. Like you say, you finish it. We finished Atomic Hercules before we stuck it out. You know, the reliability of people on Kickstarter is fine. You know, I've had Kickstarter's end and had the book in my hands a week later. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's more and more people doing it that way around. And I think it's partially there's some of us who are going, well, I'm not going to back it unless that's
I think you're right.
The position. I either know the person or
I'm a bit dubious of backing people who are American or British creators who are currently busy in the industry otherwise. Because I think, what if they get a gig at Marvel? This will be delayed another year. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll see. Although I do keep doing it. Mike Grell, I have faith in you. Any day now, it's coming through. What else are you reading at the moment? Any books you wanted to recommend? Anything that you've got in your read pile at the moment?
So, when I just... Let me lean over to pick it up. What I just finished, in terms of actually trades, was The Spider King by Josh Van and Simone D'Armini, which was an IDW book from a few years back. I picked it up partially because I got a commission of Simon, and I thought, I'll give a crack at one of these other books. And actually, it's really, really good. And you'll pick it up quite dirt cheap off Amazon and other more reputable booksellers. So yeah, that's would be my wee recommendation of that. Beyond that, it's also just over there is things like MI666, which I read the other day.
Have you taken a picture with your hand? That's what we like. Yeah.
No. Having been made fun of for taking four picture faces of my reaction to reading Atomic Hercules 2.
I'll send you one of my reaction to reading your comic. It was a much happier one.
I replaced
that with another part of my body and sent it to Vince privately, but I can't trust him enough to. Yeah, good stuff, man. So, remind me to send you Tony Osmond. I'll send Tony Osmond after this. You can have a little preview, but yeah, there's some other things coming.
Cool, good.
Good stuff, man. And where can we find you? Where can we find you online?
So if you just search Penn Le Guin on any form of social media, that's PennedGuin, you'll find me. Or if you want my personal Twitter, it's at Shadow1972.
Cool. And you can find me at neverironanything.blogspot.com, buy my comics, neverironanything.bigcartel.com, and you find me on Twitter, Ezoyez, E-Z-O-H-Y-E-Z. I'm not sure how long I'll be on Twitter for. I'm just reading messages sent to me at the moment. It all seems a bit dreadful at the moment, but we'll see. Thanks, man. That's really good. And... I'm sure we'll keep talking after this, and we'll think of something else to talk about that's slightly less rapey. Cheers, man. See you soon.